This is the Hinckley Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. The Utah State Legislature wrapped up their 2014 general session last week. Lawmakers and Count My Vote organizers compromised to give candidates an alternative around the state's party caucus and convention system to get on the primary ballot. Lawmakers also passed on to the governor several clean air bills, and they also passed legislation dealing with campaign contributions and greater transparency in light of the scandal surrounding former Attorney General John Swallow. But other bills, such as House Speaker Becky Lockhart's proposal to spend more than $200 million for digital learning devices for Utah school children, did not pass. The same for a bill that would have allowed Utah to create stricter emissions laws than those set by the federal EPA to improve air quality. And lawmakers did not reach a decision on Medicaid expansion and whether to take federal money for health care for the poor. Every year, the Hinckley Institute invites a panel of legislators to gather and reflect on the past session. But earlier this week, it was only the Democrats who showed up, Senator Gene Davis and Representative Joel Briscoe. State Senate President Republican Wayne Niederhauser and Republican Representative Brad Dee, who were invited, were unable to attend. The panel was moderated by Morgan Leoncotti.
Thank you. Thank you. We have a great crowd today, and we're excited about this legislative wrap-up. You may be able to tell that we do have half a panel right now, but we will be continuing on. We have our Democratic legislators, who, interestingly enough, decided to sit on the right-hand side chairs. But hey, it all works. We're joined this afternoon by Senator Gene Davis. He's the minority leader in the Senate. He represents District 3 in Salt Lake, and he has been a legislator for quite some time. He was in the House from 1987 to 1999 and has been in the Senate since that time. We also have Representative Joel Briscoe with us. He's the minority caucus manager in the House. He represents District 25 in Salt Lake City. He's been in the House since 2010. And he has the distinction of being a U of U grad, graduated in English. So let's move forward. One of the questions that we like to start each year, just to get the conversation rolling, we want to know what went well during the session. What was the greatest success, or what was your greatest achievement? Either of you.
First of all, I'd like to say that we're on the audience's left. Kind of explained that. We decided to do that. So when you looked at us, we were on the improper form, if you will. I think the one thing that we always start a session with, and with one goal in mind, and that's a balanced budget. And we did that. Constitutionally, we have to do that. So that was probably one of the major goals that we had and that passed. Did we have enough money? Probably not. I mean, when we take a look at what didn't get funded and what did, I think we can see that there were many shortfalls. These are shortfalls that we need to address in the future going forward. Funding is always a challenge. When I take a look at the university's 5.26% increase in your enrollment costs, I think we need to take a look. We need to make it more affordable and better for everyone. So I think personal successes, I think as minority leader, we got through the bills and the funding issues that we identified and needed to take care of. And we took care of those and worked very well with the majority party in making sure that those happened.
Things that went well?
Sure.
As a co-founder of the bipartisan Clean Air Caucus, we had a lot of attention paid to clean air issues. Almost $4.7 million was appropriated specifically for clean air issues, $750,000 to help the conversion of people who only have wood to heat their homes to convert to natural gas or a cleaner fuel, $1.4 million so researchers at institutions like the University of Utah can do research on air quality that's specific to this basin and this state, so we don't have to depend upon EPA regulations based on air quality models from the East Coast or California. $500,000 to hire four full-time equivalent positions at the Department of Environmental Quality. Some of the activists who are my good friends believe that because we didn't get everything we asked for, we failed. I beg to differ and I beg to disagree. As a former school teacher, one of the things I've learned about the legislature is that we're on a cost and education process with 103 other legislators and teaching them what they need to know. And in 45 days, you have a lot thrown at you. It's drinking water from a fire hose, and it's good that we have a lot of people around us that we trust. So we have attorneys that we talk to. It's just, the judges and the attorneys start talking, and I can't follow it all. A lot of people look to me and say, is this a good education bill or not? Air quality is complex. Pollution's not an easy issue to get your head around. Those of us on the Air Quality Caucus have spent about 5 months having a meeting a month, and we brought in a lot of experts. Democrats prioritize for public safety. We got $600,000 for domestic violence shelters, which means that there'll be more support for women who report domestic violence cases and more beds for them to be safe with their families. $750,000 to speed up processing, a backlog of processing of rape kits. We got Representative Polson passed an intimate images bill to put Utah on the books to be able to prosecute in certain circumstances boyfriends or girlfriends who take, or girlfriends who take pictures that maybe in a not so sane moment someone let them take of you, and then they're turned around and used to punish what some people call revenge porn. We got a 2.5% increase in the weighted pupil unit for public schools, and we funded growth. Of the $133 million new dollars in public education, $122 million was those two items. And I don't think everyone in Utah has really wrapped their head around how much money it costs just to keep up and keep our noses barely above water so we don't take in salt water. That's a quick view.
Thank you. On the last night of the session, Robert Gerke tweeted, "The governor apparently says the legislative session was a success. That's unexpected." So for him, that was one of his biggest surprises. For both of you, what was one of your biggest surprises of the session?
I was disappointed that we did not come to some, that there are still 50 to 60,000 Utahns a day who are in the gap and are not getting any health care coverage. And Gene knows more about that than I do, with the speaker of this, with the Senate president and the governor of the state of Utah saying, we're going to fix this problem. I thought we might find a resolution.
I think the one thing on the Medicaid expansion is what we're talking about here, the individuals who don't have access to health care. We were able to give the governor a little something to go back to Washington, D.C. and begin talking to the feds about expanding Medicaid in the state of Utah. What that will be, we don't know yet. It's my hope, and the Democrats led the fight on the floor to go to full expansion of Medicaid to 138%, and that failed. However, the idea that was brought forth from the House did not succeed. And Senator Shiozawa had a bill that did that. There's one thing I think in health care that we want to look at. There's Medicaid expansion. But I think the other thing that was really eventful was the fact that autistic children are going to get the service that they need, as we mandated the insurance companies. And it's up to the governor now to sign that. But if that goes forward, we'll mandate that the insurance companies cover the benefits and treatment of autism, or the autism spectrum, which I think was a very positive thing that we moved forward during the session.
Great. So, Representative Briscoe, you were saying that we had a lot of success with clean air bills this year, and those have struggled in the past. So what do you think the turning point was, and perhaps you can please chime in as well, Senator Davis, if you agree or disagree. So what was that turning point? And for those people who are saying it wasn't a turning point, we needed to do more, what more are they wanting?
The turning point from my perspective was incredibly clear. It was 1 year ago. It was the winter of 2012-2013. We'd had that horrific shooting in Sandy Hook Elementary. I went into the session believing that the issue that was going to take predominance was the issue of the appropriate use of guns in schools, who should carry them, how they should be trained, whether the NRA had the best idea of having a policeman or someone trained in every school. But that faded, and it was air quality, and it was pollution. And the inversion, the public, Arthur C. Clarke says every good idea goes through three stages. And the first stage is, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, and it will never, ever work. The second stage is, well, okay, it might work, but it's still a dumb idea. And the third stage is, that was the best idea, and I told you so all along. So, you know, if you go back and ask how many people who were actually voted in the election of 1960 who voted for Kennedy, it was like, what, 48 to 47%? But 65% of the people tell you they voted for Kennedy. So there's a tipping point, right? There's a tipping point where something, you have to expend a lot of energy, and then there's a tipping point, then everyone says it's a good idea. So after December and January of last year, the inversions, all of a sudden, we were being inundated with phone calls and emails about clean air. And I sat next to Representative Patrice Arant, and we said, let's run some clean air bills. And in 2 weeks, we cobbled together seven clean air bills. At the end of the session, she said, let's form a clean air caucus. We form a clean air caucus. The governor's office received these phone calls, but the public said, do something about the air and pollution. Do something. We're tired of it. I've been thinking as a history minor and a guy who took a lot of political science classes about the theory of revolutions. One of the theories is, for all you poli-sci majors out there, that sometimes revolutions occur not when things are bad, but when things are starting to get better and the pace of change isn't fast enough. The air is getting better, but you know what? We still have these crappy days and we get these crappy weeks. When my wife and I got married in 1980, we lived in 4th and C. We had an inversion that went 30 days. I remember having to walk up above LDS Hospital, look out over the valley. The air had a color to it. It was kind of this orangey-brown color, and it smelled awful. We don't have them that long anymore, but people expect better, and all of a sudden we're getting these crappy air days still, despite all the effort we've made. The public had enough, and they've asked us to do something about it. We're responding.
We passed, as was mentioned, we passed a number of bills. Number of things undone. One is giving the Department of Air Quality the ability to go beyond just the federal standards. And we wanted to repeal that one section, and then we tried to amend it as well. Both of those failed. And what that would have done, about 24 years ago, there was a bill that was passed that said we cannot adopt any rules or regulations more stringent than the federal standard guidelines. Those guidelines are actually stopping us from getting to Tier 3 gasoline, to doing other things that address Utah's own inversion problems or the dirt that's in those inversions. It's obvious we can't get rid of the inversion itself. That's an event of Mother Nature. But we can lower the amount of dirt that's in that air. And I think we began discussing that during this session. I think next year I hope we can soften, if not do away with that standards more stringent than the federal government. If we can move that off the books, I think we have scientists, we have the public, we have ideas that we can move forward that may be a bit more stringent than the federal standards and bring us into compliance with the standards in a cleaner air or cleaner particulate matter, less particulate matter in the air when we have these bad air days, these inversions.
Air doesn't look in your wallet to see your party registration. One of the Republicans that worked, and on most of these bills, Republicans and Democrats were working side by side. We're sponsors and co-sponsors. We were talking to one Republican who was working hard with us, and he told us that when he goes to church on Sunday, his deeply read Republican constituent churchgoers were saying, when are you going to do something about the air? So, you know, potholes may not have a party label attached to them. Bad air doesn't have a party label attached to it. It affects everyone's health.
You're listening to the Hinckley Radio Hour on KCPW and a panel discussion with Utah lawmakers about this past legislative session. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, Utah state legislators gathered this week for a panel discussion, but only the Democrats, Senator Gene Davis and Representative Joel Briscoe, showed up. Republican lawmakers were unable to attend. The panel was moderated by Morgan Leoncati.
Thank you. Let's switch gears. A common observation a lot of people were making about the Count My Vote initiative and about SB 54 was that the session ends Thursday night. Friday morning, you are filing for re-election, and the next week, you will be attending your caucus meetings, and that had a strong influence on the debate. Do you think it would have been different if the timing had been different, if this hadn't been an election year, or if perhaps you'd had more of a cushion in that timing?
You go first.
I think the Count My Vote issue was one that was being brought forward and being pushed. It was actually, and I wish my colleagues from the other side of the aisle were here, because it's really something I viewed as being a problem that was within the Republican Party itself and in their choice of trying to get candidates. We haven't had that big of a problem as Democrats in the state of Utah. And they had some real tensions that had developed and with their caucus system and with the idea of having primaries, open primaries. And as I studied what was in that, there was not an open primary situation. It was actually a closed primary would have continued. And Kurt Bramble tried to work within his own party, tried to bring solutions together, tried to bring people together. And as it came down, it was really a battle. And finally, there was a conclusion that was reached. And we jumped on board with that and voted the bill forward. And it was resolved. And was it resolved in the right way? Was it resolved wrong? I think the upcoming election will tell that. The one thing that happens every 2 years is the fact that we do end up with the registrations beginning the day after the session and going for 10 days. And that's the process that we're in right now. It seems a little more collapsed, if you will, because of the fact that it started on Friday because of the convention system and when the conventions are. This was the week that really fit to be able to hold those caucus meetings. And I hope on whether it be tomorrow night or whether it be on Thursday night that all of you attend your caucus meetings and get involved and become part of the process.
As a former government teacher, I can't let this moment pass, so by raise of hands, how many of you know where your caucus is on Tuesday or Thursday night? You know who you are. Vote.utah.gov, put in your address, and then put in your street number, put in your zip code, and it will tell you where they are. Mine's at Emerson Elementary. His is at several different locations. Because he's a senator, and he's more important than a lowly member of the House of Representatives. So the question was, what if the caucuses had been in April or May? Would there have been the impetus? I think yes. When one of the House co-sponsors started pulling Democratic leadership off the floor of the House and saying, here's what we're looking at, I can tell you there was genuine fear on the part of many Republican legislators that they might lose the caucus system. And I have friends. You know, I signed a Count My Vote petition. I did not go out and pass them around. I did not go out and do a heavy lift on my own to make it happen. But the fact that they believed, they spent $1 million, I'm told, I have no idea whether that's true, but everything I read in the press I know is true, right? And the press said they spent $1 million, so they spent a grundle of money. They probably had over 100,000 signatures. There's a man in the back who can tell us how money they got. And the fact that they had that, and they believed they had that, if you're playing prisoner's dilemma here, meant they had a stick to negotiate with. And they gave. The people who want the caucus system gave. What did they give up? They gave up closed primaries. So 2 years from now in 2016, if some Republican wants to go out and get 28,000 signatures to get on the ballot against Mike Lee, they're guaranteed if they get those signatures and they get on the ballot that it's not just people who have a little card that says Republican get a vote. All the unaffiliated voters get to vote as well. The other thing they gave up is when they go out. So if I wanted to run for state senator or something, I could go out and get 2,000 signatures. As a Democrat, I can get them from anyone. Anyone who lives in my district who's a registered voter, libertarian, communist, Republican, Democrat, Green, you name it, I can get them to sign. That's a big give. They were genuinely scared they would lose caucuses. And these are people who got their positions because of caucuses. Why would we expect them to turn around and go, oh, whatever, what the heck, let's just do primaries? I won a primary in 2010. I won a caucus battle. I've won two general election battles. I've done it all. Primaries are hard to work. They are more expensive. I love my delegates. I loved all those people I got to know so well, and I'm going to meet again tomorrow night. I just love the system. I just love politics. I mean, I'm sick in the head, but whatever way. But the compromise, I don't think, had anything to do with the time factor. I think it had to do just with the structure, and they wanted to preserve caucuses. And so they gave some to keep some. Each side got some of what they wanted. I thought it was a great compromise.
Okay, great. I'm going to ask one more question, then we're going to take questions from the audience. But one of the questions that I know a lot of people are curious about is Speaker Lockhart's education technology bill, that she was hoping to get $200 to $300 million for this grand technology bill, put tablets in the hands of each student, and the Senate offered $26 million, and eventually the entire thing is quashed. So from the insider's perspective of people who were there, can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, I think I can tell you what happened because I engaged in dialogue with Representative Gibson, and we had a number of discussions along the way. And I had a two-on-one with another Democratic legislator and the Speaker. First of all, I want to tip my hat to the Speaker and compliment her for being willing to put together a bold proposal. And what I think has been lost here is that the Speaker came up with a proposal to put nine figures into public education. Some of us disagree with where that should go first, but she was talking about not a million, not 10 millions, but she was talking about putting hundreds of millions of dollars into public education. And whether or not you think giving every student a handheld computing device is the way to do that, but she made that proposal, and I give her credit for that. At one point, I was told by the people who were pushing this that if it involved a tax increase, they were going to walk away from it, and they did. You hear stories in the press that the Republicans in the Senate, and he can tell us more about this, were using her desire to get this big initiative going as leverage to get the House to accept a gas tax increase, to get the House to accept something else the House didn't want to do. Was that involved in negotiations? They don't involve me in their strategy. I don't know. Ultimately, I was told they were going after transportation money. We take $500 million, $500 million out of sales tax every year, and without any vote on the part of any legislator, we drop it right into roads. It's an earmark. Okay? It's disguised. We don't see it. We don't vote on it. We voted on it once. It's done. I think she was probably willing to reach into some of that money. I don't know. The cost became too much. She wasn't willing to go for tax increase. She dropped it. I don't think the idea is dead. I think they'll come back with it in another form. I think one of the things we learned was how many school districts are actually doing some significant segment of this. You've got everyone from, I think, 5th to 12th grade in the Park City School District. Everyone has a handheld device, and they're moving it down to kindergarten. Wasatch School District, I think all their school, about half their students have a single device. My personal opinion is, if I had $300 million, would I put it into technology? Yeah. Would I put it all in technology? No. I don't think that device in and of itself is the key to educating our children better as a standalone measure.
Senator Davis?
I think the $300 million really is significant, because it really shows what we really should be putting into education. And if there's a will, there's always a way. The Senate came back in their negotiations from no to $26 million. I think it's like Senator Hilliard, who's the appropriations chairman, said, where are you going to find it? We'll fund whatever you want if you can find the money to fund it. Where do you take it from? So one thing that's always off the table is any kind of a tax increase. One of the sharp things in public education that concerns me is the fact that in 1997 dollars, according to our fiscal analyst, in public education we're spending $30 more per child in state dollars now than we did in 1997. Kind of shows you where we're at in funding public education. And we know that there's a needs in higher education as well. We have situations throughout the state, highways. I mean, we've earmarked funding for that infrastructure. There's other infrastructures in the state of Utah that need to be taken care of. And I think one of the most concerning things, according to our fiscal analyst, we could be at a zero base budget. I mean, all of the money already secured when we meet in 2017, with no growth. Just with where we're at right now. And if we experience another downturn in the economy, this state could really be in a lot of trouble, according to our fiscal analyst. Unless we begin to look and discuss about how we're going to prioritize, whether we do a tax increase. I think we can see it on the local levels that property taxes have gone up over the last 5-10 years. Not just by growth or value. We've seen one of the things that's happened in our gas tax. We could raise a lot of money if we just made it revenue neutral instead of tying it to the dollar and made it into real dollars. That was Senator Valentine's bill. But there'd be new dollars there. There's property taxes that have been capped that if we allowed them to go forward, that we could capture new dollars as well. So there's one of those things. Am I saying we've got to raise taxes all the way around? No, but at some time, we've got to take a look, the same as any business would. At what point do we start reinvesting in the state of Utah and stop resting on our laurels that we're just going to grow our way forward out of every problem that we have?
Thank you. If you have a question, please raise your hand and then wait until you have the microphone to ask it. But please raise your hand.
Hi, my name is Brianna. I'm a political science major. And my question is, do you believe that Utah's child population growth could have an issue with our public education funding and just the sharp increase in the amount of births that we do have as compared with other states, if that's a reason for why the public education budget can not be as well-rounded as it once was?
You know, being one of the youngest states in the nation leads to higher birth rates, only because we're younger. So that's a natural thing that happens there. Does it challenge us? Yes. So I gave you those numbers, the $30 more that we're spending than we did in 97. If you take a look at the actual dollars that we put into education, that really shows us where the situation is. Can we lower the birth rate and get ourselves out of this problem? I don't think so. It's a natural occurring thing. We're behind. We're like 51st in spending per child in our public education system. How do we move that forward? How do we get to the middle of the pack? How do we get to 25?
I'd settle for 48 right now.
48 would be fine. So,
let me give you an analogy. When I taught high school advanced placement comparative government for a few years, India was one of the countries studied. College Board has changed the countries. They now do Iran. The country of India adds the population of Australia every year. Just think about what that means to the country of India to add the population of Australia every single year. And you keep adding the country of Australia, and you have to add all the support those people need. We are adding next year, October 1, we anticipate there'll be 10,000 more students in Utah's K-12 public education. That's bigger than half the school districts in Utah. 10,000 kids in 1 year. And last year it was 10, 11, 12,000, and it's been somewhere between 7 and 10, 11, 12,000 for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. That's a lot of kids in 1 year, and we got to have schools for them to go to. I mean, I work in Davis County where they've got like 300 or 400 portables. I mean, they've got several schools and just portable classrooms. How long can you do that, you know? So yes. $58 million of the $133 million new dollars going into public education just to pay for a teacher, for not at any given raise, just to pay for a teacher to teach those kids coming into the system.
You're listening to the Hinckley Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Utah Democrat state legislators, Senator Gene Davis and Representative Joel Briscoe, met for a panel discussion on Monday this week. Unfortunately, Republican lawmakers were unable to attend. The panelists answered questions from an audience of University of Utah students.
To the same question about the population of children, what is the legislature doing to facilitate alternatives such as online schools, more charter school opportunities, rather than brick and mortar buildings? Because really, we're in the Jordan School District, and that's really where they're pushing is how do we build more schools? But they're not talking about the alternatives to online charter schools and some of the out-of-the-box thinking.
The legislature authorizes every year the number of students who can enroll in charter schools, and they authorize another 6,000 or 7,000 or 8,000. I think there are somewhere between 60,000 and 70,000 students in charter schools today, or will be after next year. We also appropriated money to. There are a number of things going on in terms of students who might learn best by learning online. The problem with learning online is not every student works well that way. Some do. I have a friend who teaches at Salt Lake Community College, and he's taught there over 20 years. He teaches the same class brick and mortar that he teaches online the same semester. He brings in his online students once and says, here's my schedule for the rest of the year. You want to come in, you're struggling 1 week, come in and sit in on my brick and mortar class. The number of students who don't complete his online class and have to retake it is many times over the number of students who complete his brick and mortar class. I mean, Western Governors University has done a great job of offering a college education to people in North Dakota. We saw that ad several years ago. For some students, it's great. It's tremendous. It's a great opportunity. I just don't think you're ever going to get an elementary school. Maybe one day we'll be in Star Trek land and we'll have those kind of computers. Robert Kurzweil thinks we will. But in the meantime, we're going to need both. And I see more and more education in the future being blended like they're doing at Innovations down on the South High Salt Lake Community College campus, where Salt Lake City is running a high school there, which they're doing a more blended approach, which is a combination of teachers in the classroom and kids with computers doing stuff online. But we're doing a lot there. I just don't think that's the entire answer to the problem.
I think the one thing is that you really need to take a look. How does a person learn? You just put somebody in front of a screen and say, okay, start reading. There's always guidance, and that's the great thing about teaching. They're guides. They kind of sit down with children and help them. Look back at your first years in school. I think that's probably the quickest way is to reflect back on those teachers that you had, that gave you help, that began that process of education. And I think technology is one of those things as we grow, especially technology in the classroom, can help a child grow at rapid paces in a lot of different areas. So technology in the classroom is very, very important. I think if we take a look at some of the online stuff that's going on as well, and I believe Senator Henderson from down in Spanish Fork, down in Utah County, pointed out that she had enrolled her children in some of these online programs for school, and they failed every class. But yet they paid for them. So there needs to be some check, and the state paid for it. The check and balance has to be there. Really, it's education is one of those things that you can teach children what to learn, or you can take the tremendous stretch, and that's how to learn. And hopefully that's where you're going to be in the future, is a continuing learning situation all of your life. That's what great education is about. It's one of the things that I remember a study that was done a number of years ago by Ted Turner and a group who went around the world looking at the education systems around the world and how we could improve our own education system here in the United States. And they came back with one thing. When they took a look at all of the Pulitzer Prizes, all of the other prize winners, most all of them were coming from the United States, where people were taught how to learn, not what to learn. So we have to make sure that online challenges your mind to grow, not just dead ends it with this is the answer and that's the way it has to be.
There's a columnist on public education in the Washington Post. A few years ago, we were at the Olympics in China. They were talking about Chinese students, young men who were playing such wonderful brand of basketball on the outdoor courts and how Yao Ming was so important to them. One man's theory was that their society is so regimented that this was providing them an outlet that they didn't get in their regimented society. He said, and like I said, everything we read in the press is true, correct, that no Chinese national has won a Nobel Prize who was educated inside a Chinese school. Every Chinese national who's won a Nobel Prize was educated in America or somewhere in Europe. And one of the great things about our culture is our vivacity, our entrepreneurial spirit, our creativity, and I hope we don't lose that. My great fear is that we started to under No Child Left Behind when we started turning to very prescriptive multiple choice tests to determine whether our schools or teachers were doing well. Teachers started teaching to that. As a systems theorist, I know that my belief is people will do what they're rewarded to do. And if you're going to reward my pay and my job tenure and whether my school stays open or not according to a test, show me what the test is and I'll teach to it. I'm less concerned about the Common Core standards than I am about the Common Core assessments. Because as soon as the teachers figure out how the students will be rewarded on the tests, that's how they will teach their kids. If the assessments are good and want kids to be creative and learn how to write and think, then that's how the teachers will teach. If they only want a bunch of simple regurgitation of information, teachers will give them that. Because that's how we've decided they should be rewarded.
And that's called success. I think there's someone at the back of me.
I'm Aline. I'm a non-traditional student here at the U. And it seems that here in the state of Utah, you mention education, and we say, oh, yes, whatever we have to do. Then it comes to raising taxes. Oh, no, no, no. So we follow like sheep with whatever you recommend. I think you'd agree with that. Why has nobody recommended a lottery or some thinking outside the box that would fund our education system, including the legalization of marijuana?
You know, I take a look at the lottery system and the gaming systems that are out there. California tried that. It was great to build buildings, but it's very, very inconsistent in ongoing funding to be able to pay on an ongoing way. Because it varies a lot, so you have to be wary of that as well. I mean, if you're building a building, that may be a way to do it, because you're actually bonding with people betting on the come. But to do it in the classroom, and California ran into some real problems when they started using that money instead of building. They started using it for teaching, and pretty soon they were behind the eight ball as the economy turned down, and less money went in. Also in gaming issues, it's really poorer people that use more of their affordable income to be able to bet and to make those wagers. And they don't have that money to be able to do it. So you have to be careful how you do that. And I think we have been in the state of Utah.
You said lottery or?
Marijuana.
Marijuana. Yeah. Okay. I've talked to some legislators in Washington and Colorado, and one of the reasons they believe the voters passed the initiatives was they were told, look, we'll tax it and we'll get some money. They're not quite sure that they're going to make money off of it. I heard one man on TV say, wait till people find out you can grow this in your backyard or you're in your shed or in your garage. He wonders whether people will just take away, you know, the business side of it by growing it themselves. I think we need 2 or 3 or 4 years to see just whether that works for marijuana. For Colorado and Washington, and in this state, you can just kiss legalizing marijuana goodbye. It's not going to happen.
Though we did legalize cannabis oil.
If you really want to do that, there's states around us you can go to, but I'm not really holding my breath on legalizing marijuana in the state of Utah. But that's a novel suggestion, and I have a person who emails me once a year asking me to run a bill legalizing marijuana.
Maybe we could find the right level of excise tax on it. That might work.
Senator Davis, you, at the very beginning, you mentioned one of the successes as the balanced budget that we've got. That is in the Utah Constitution.
Right.
One of the bills that failed in the House was H.J.R. 8, calling for a...
Con-con.
Yeah, a con-con for the balanced budget on a national level. and Democrats in the House voted against that. So I'm just curious about the difference between, well, and I guess you didn't necessarily say that you were glad that Utah had a balanced budget in its constitution, but maybe the difference on those two levels and any concern, well, I'll just leave it at that.
CONCON's been around for a long, long time, and was actually passed in the state of Utah in the 80s. We repealed it, our ask, we got the votes through, and then we repealed that. It's an interesting theory, but I take a look at the Affordable Care Act, and one of the reasons I don't agree with the federal balanced budget. We couldn't have fought World War II if we had have done that. I mean, the federal government needs to be able to reach out, or somebody needs to be able to reach out in hard times to be able to assist. I take a look at here in the state of Utah in the Affordable Care Act. There's a balanced budget amendment. When things go south in the state of Utah, we see our Medicaid rolls go up. We're going to see the same thing under the Affordable Care Act. Individuals who lose their ability, their job, they're going to be drawing unemployment, but they're also going to be stuck without health care. Under the Affordable Care Act, it gives us that stream back and forth. And we only have to come up with 10% of that Medicaid dollar into the future. So I think it's a nice idea, this whole idea of having the national balance. But if we're doing what we should do and not locked like they are in Washington, D.C. right now on partisan lines, especially in the House, we probably could have lowered our deficit immensely just by bringing about tax fairness in this country. We hear a lot of talk about it, but if you want a program, you got to pay for it. The problem here, we're under the balanced budget. We all want a better education system, but we're locked on how much money we can spend by the fact that we have to balance our budget and nobody wants to raise taxes. So you can never get to that equilibrium that we really need in our society.
I've sponsored a bill to increase funding for public education each of the 4 years I've been up there. For the past 2 years, we've had a Republican, Senator Osmond, sponsor a bill to increase funding for public education. Let me tell you why I voted against the CONCON. I think it's revisionist history. I've read their arguments. There's a certain logic to them. It's the kind of logic you can have by sitting in someone's classroom, listening to an erudite professor say, oh, but this all makes so much sense. But in order for me to buy their arguments, I have to buy into their assertion that the Constitutional Convention of 1787 was doing exactly what they were told to do, and that they didn't violate any laws or rules. That's bogus nonsense. That's revisionist history. Okay? And I find it difficult to believe that you could elect a group of people from 50 states, put them together in a hall, and they wouldn't feel a sense of history and go, hey, we're all together. We've been waiting for this for 200 years. Let's do the Constitution. Let's go have some fun. You know, let's go fix everything now. Right? I just don't buy that argument that that's not going to come to pass. I also think it's a false analogy to say the national budget, which is a mess, is the same as my budget at home. I just don't think anyone who takes a good economic study of history and how budgets are put together, works for an MPA program or anything, can come to the same conclusion that we should run the federal budget like that. Wayne Owens, Congressman Owens years ago, I think this idea should be revived, said we should have two budgets. We should have a fixed operating federal budget and we should have an investment budget. When you go into debt, when this state goes into debt to put people through med school, we put hundreds of thousands of dollars into those young men and women knowing up front we're going into debt, but the productivity and the health that we're going to generate by training young men and young women to be great doctors is worth that expense up front, right? So we don't, you know, we don't get into some little accounting game whether or not whether they can pay for themselves right now. We should do the same thing with education. We should do the same thing with rebuilding our infrastructure in this country. And we should be willing to put that money up front because better harbors, better airports, better bridges, better roads and trails, better air is in the long run going to pay off for us.
Yeah, one last question.
See that furry, hairy guy right there?
I'd be interested if there was a olfactory scale of Utah politics, with zero being very, very smelly fecal material, and 10 being a wonderful, sweet-smelling after a desert storm. Utah politics is near zero or in a negative number. Why was there no ethics bill of significance passed in this legislative session?
There were some coming out of the House investigation of Swallow. There were a few things that were done. Should there be more? I think we're ongoing looking at that all the time on the ethics. There's a number of things that are up there, a number of ideas. And I would say that, having been up there for a few years, that, yeah, there's some things that go on that may not pass some people's smell tests, but there's other things that are going on up there that are really moving the state forward. And I think it is the discussion.
I hate people who interrupt other people. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Finish it up.
Politics is risk averse. You know, people don't want to go out and make a lot of real big moves. And we did clean up a few little things that were recommended. There were a few things in terms of reporting requirements and other things that were fixed. But there was one significant bill that I voted for in the House that was defeated. And all I could think of sitting in my chair was I would like to be the Republican or Democratic challenger to people who put a big red no vote up on that board on that bill. I would take that. I would take that vote and a couple of other votes, and it would be on my campaign literature, and I would be talking about it door to door.
Which one was that?
I can't remember. So we'd look at 800 pieces of legislation in 45 days, and I think a third of our votes come the last 3 days. All you do is sit at your computer and go, what does this bill say? What is it? You try and read them the night before. You fall asleep trying to read 20 or 30 bills. Then you come in the morning, and they put 10 more up on top of them. You're reading them as fast as you can.
Ask the audience on a 0 to 10 scale, going 1, 2, 3, where they think the smell of Utah politics is.
Okay, so 10's a honeysuckle rose, and 0 is the worst thing you can smell. How many of you say Utah politics is a 10? 9, 8. You turn around and look, Pat. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. So just me looking, I'd say their average is right.
Five.
Three or four.
So it was pretty well in the middle, I think.
On the bottom end of five, below five.
So, yeah, are there some things we can do? Absolutely. Are there some things that can be done by the general public by paying more attention and turning out to elect?
Representative King's bill to put a $10,000 limit on contributions. When John Huntsman was governor, his first race, he took $50,000 from Patrick Burnham, Overstock.com. I think he thought better of it because he went to Greg Bell, who was a state senator, and said, would you please run a bill for me? And he was very public about this in the press, which caps limits on campaign contributions to any statewide office at $10,000. Senator Bell did so. He could not get it out of his Senate committee. He could not even get it. We are the wild, wild west when it comes to campaign limits. And I think that's an egregious mistake. And we make a mistake if we say this is about John Swallow. If we believe the Founding Fathers, then what the Founding Fathers said is human beings are human beings. And there's angels among them, and then there's the rest of us. And a few people make angel status, and then there's the rest of us. And you put us in certain situations, and we're going to be tempted. Is John Swallow the only man in Utah politics who's ever going to be tempted by greed and access and this ability of funding campaigns? I don't think so. I mean, I think we make a mistake to make it about a personality. I think we need to make a look at a system that enables that kind of activity. And we tightened down a few of the screws. We closed a few of the hatches. We didn't close them all.
It's one thing, too, and that's the fact power corrupts. Absolute power really corrupts.
All right, we just have about 2 or 3 more minutes, so just one quick final question from me. You've both mentioned that there were several things that were undone during the session, so what can we expect out of the interim and the special sessions?
Clean Our Caucus is not going away. We're going to come back again. Democrats and Republicans are going to come back again. We're going to come back with a lot more bills dealing with air quality.
Not only that, we're going to continue the education task force, looking at public education, and hopefully find that solution to be able to really address the core need of education, which I believe is funding. That is a mechanism that has to be addressed sooner rather than later.
And if your counterparts were here, what do you think they would say?
Who? Our counterparts?
Your Republican counterparts.
I've been
Representative Aaron said I should never speak for the opposition.
All right.
Ray Stevens had a song out. I remember many, many years ago. It's called Everything is Beautiful in its own way.
There's a lot of great things going on in the state of Utah. I'm proud to be a Utahan. I love living in this state. My question is, can we do it better? My question is, can we take what's really good now and can we do it even better? I think we can.
And that's our challenge, being on this side of the aisle, the way it's made up right now.
I'm not sad.
Challenging the other side to do better and to be better.
I'm not satisfied with being good. I want to be great. And I think there are things we can do to make Utah great.
All right, thank you for joining us. And the audience, please join me in a round of applause. Thank
you. You've been listening to the Hinckley Radio Hour. This program was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. You can hear this program again and other podcasts on KCPW's website. And join us every Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. for other forums on local, national, and international issues important to people living in Utah. I'm Ross Chambliss, and this is KCPW.